It's a double whammy on our latest episode of Soundtracking as we bring you two extremely talented ladies charting very different courses in the world of cinema. First up is Hilda Gottinottie, well known to fans of this podcast on which she's featured by proxy many, many times. Hilda has gained broader and much deserved recognition for her work on Joker, Todd Phillips' origin story about the eponymous supervillain that has proved hugely popular amongst movie fans and critics alike. If you haven't seen it yet, Joaquin Phoenix's performance is astonishing, as is Hilda's suitably disturbing score. I think it's a masterpiece. Then we have Dolly Wells, a much-loved British comedy actor who's just made Good Posture. Now, she and I have more of a chat about her career in television and film than your usual focus on music, but she is an utter delight, so we really wanted to share it with you. But we begin with Hilda and her very first cue from Joker, Hoyt's Office. Hilda, thank you so much for sparing the time to talk to us on Soundtrack. And you've featured quite a lot, actually, in the 3 years since we started. Had a wonderful conversation with Garth Davis about you.
Oh, lovely.
We spoke to him about Mary Magdalene, was a gorgeous score. But let's talk about Now, first of all, if that's okay.
Yes, of course.
And I, last week, had the pleasure, it was slightly nerve-wracking leading up to the event, but the pleasure of hosting a Q&A with Todd and Joaquin Joker.
Yeah, great.
And the film is extraordinary. I think it's one of my films of the year. I think it's a masterpiece in so many levels.
Beautiful.
And can I take you back to the first conversations that you had about that film, how it was presented to you, at what stage it was at, and what was given to you, I guess.
Yeah, so so I just got an email from Todd Phillips, who asked if I was interested in reading a script on a for a film that he was working on, and which I of course was, and so he sent me the script and which I read, and I loved it. I really fell in love with the way that he was telling the story of this, you know, character that I had grown up with, and it was such a beautiful approach to a really complicated character. And so he asked if I was interested in writing some music based on my feelings that I got from the script, and which I of course was as well, because I just connected so strongly to it on a somehow like a physical and emotional level. Because it's quite different, I think, when you're reading a script or a book, because you have so much space to kind of imagine the world and the pacing, and you're kind of, you know, you enter the story from a completely different space than when you're like watching a film, or when you're like, you know, you're being led with your eyes and not your kind of physical feeling of the story. So I thought it was a really exciting approach, and I sat down to write some music, and Todd was familiar with my solo albums, which are quite largely led by the cello. So he kind of wanted the cello to be a kind of center role. And that was pretty much the only direction as such that I had. So he didn't really, he just wanted to hear what I felt.
Yeah.
And so we didn't talk at all about tonality or pacing or any such things. And when I sat down to try to find my way into expressing it musically, what I had felt. I, you know, was kind of fumbling around for a while, and then somehow when I just these notes, I mean, this doesn't happen. This is not my normal process, and it doesn't happen all the time. But it was just like when his notes came to me, I just got this kind of, it was like being struck by lightning in the chest. It was like,
that's it.
And I just had to hold my breath, and I was like, that's him. That's him. There he is. So I started recording, and then the first kind of themes were born, which I then like did the arrangements of sent to Todd, and he just loved what I had done, and just felt that it was really exactly the story that he wanted to tell. It's just such a beautiful privilege when you can collaborate like that, when you don't have to have a big dialogue about what you're trying to say, or, you know, if you can just like really, without too many words, just be in complete agreement about the story, because our story, of course, can be told in a million different ways.
Exactly.
And the music, of course, is such a big part of the storytelling. So it's just such a wonderful... It's just such a wonderful place to start a collaboration in such strong agreement. Mm. So I sent him a lot of this music, which he then used as they were starting to shoot. And Joaquin just actually told me this a few weeks ago, and
he talked about it last week.
Yes, exactly.
That 1,500 people.
Yeah,
yeah, it was incredible to hear.
Yeah, exactly. Because he was kind of, you know, it's such a complex character, and this transformation that he goes through is quite complex, because it's a character that he's almost become a real life character, even though he is fictional, because he's just been such a big part of people of my generation, yeah, from the 70s, 80s, 90s have such a strong connection
so
to him.
Familiar,
yes,
with him.
Exactly, and to specific performances of him, and as his origin story has never been told, you know, it's a complicated subject to access.
And, he's a man, though. That's I mean, the cello is such a physical instrument, in the way that, you know, you're hugging it. You're touching it. There's a connection there. To feel this character through that. I love the notion. And I think that that's what your music, for me anyway, with the film, really reminds you of, that this is a person. This is a man.
Yes, exactly.
Who's kind of been tossed aside by...
Yes.
Society, the system, his family.
That's
the connection, I think.
Yes,
it's so powerful.
And I think, you know, you can access these sort of feelings on a much stronger level when you don't have words getting in your way. Mm. You know, when you can really access these feelings on a visceral level and a kind of almost like a kind of animal instinct level, you know, and that's sort of somehow like how the whole dialogue was, because it was so wordless, you know, and it was just like, it was somehow like everyone was just experiencing it without talking about it. And that's somehow what, as Joaquin was having a hard time finding his way into this transformation and finding his way into the character, and Todd started playing him the music on Sat. And, he, of course, had no idea what I had felt when I made the music, But the response that he had specifically in the bathroom scene is when the kind of this transformation happens is a direct response of Joaquin's response to the music, and he's like doing a choreography that was it was not in the script at all, and this scene was not planned at all, and it was really just like his physical interaction to hearing the music. Was just so magical for me because this was exactly how I had experienced it.
Yeah.
And this was exactly how I, you know, the movements that he did were exactly from the same place as where I had felt this, you know, movement to his character. So it was just like, I mean, it all sounds pretty fantastical when you when you explain it, but it's really like how it happened. And it was just so interesting that we had never had a discussion about it. I had never, I mean, I did go visit the set, but, you know, I didn't want to get in anyone's way. So I didn't really talk to many people. So I was just kind of going by the walls.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we never talked about this while they were shooting, and we never talked about it in the process. And then it wasn't until like the night before the premiere in Venice that we met for a drink, and we were
that
just
was the
like
first time you
yes
met?
Yeah yeah
oh my god
yes I mean I had met him a couple of times before, but we had never met to talk about this, and he was like, I can't believe like this is what I was experiencing, and I was like, but that's what I was experiencing. And it was so beautiful, and I think it's a real privilege to get to be a part of a process that you where you feel like all the elements are growing so organically together, where you don't feel like, you know, you're not following anybody's temp or the last cut, or you're not, you know, trying to run after any sort of outside influences. You're just being led by feelings. And it was a very magical process.
Well, it was wonderful to read as well, even from Todd's DOP, Lawrence, that whole scene completely changed because of how Joaquin then found Fleck basically within that piece, and so that then informed so much. It changed everything.
Yes, exactly.
That's incredible.
Yeah. No, it's really really quite magical. Very special. A really special process to be a part of. It was really nice.
There was some other cues as well that really resonated with me. I mean, that's a really obvious one that he's obviously talked about and stuff as well, but there's some other stuff as well. One of my favorite cues is Penny taken to hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
Yeah.
It's really the emotion that is so powerful. Thank you. once you'd kind of started that musical dialogue with Todd in terms of just writing the music and sending it mm-hmm. to him, did you then get to see bits and bobs of things?
Yes, yeah. So I wrote quite a few themes and sent over to him, and he used the themes that he resonated with the most for the shooting, and then as they were shooting, the bathroom dance was the first scene that they mm-hmm. sent me, and then he sent me a few more dailies, and then I started to write more music and then dialogue to what I saw.
Yeah.
And so then the process of really responding to the picture and responding to the pacing that they were doing and how everything looked, you know, then that dialogue began. So there's obviously quite a lot of the music that's just directly also responding to them. So it was a quite nice, like, back and forth, you know, that we had in that sense. And Penny taken to the hospital is like an interaction with the scene as well. As well as, of course, the ending, you know, which is that's very much in response to the scene and how it looks and how the pacing is cut so there's quite a lot of scoring to film as well.
Yeah. I loved also the following Sophie mm-hmm. cue as well.
Yeah.
There's just this lovely kind of sort of low pounding.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The idea, I guess, hearing you talk about the cello and you use this specific electric cello, is it mm-hmm. right? That kind
yeah.
of that is part of the I guess, the heart of the score, really. That
yeah,
is
yeah.
Would that be a fair assumption?
Yes, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. It plays a really big role in the score.
Thank you.
one of the instruments that I've been developing with a friend for like the last 10-12 years or
so.
Yeah. No, that's a lot of my work and a lot of my interest is based around instrument design as well. A film score is really kind of just one part of the work that I do. So instrument design is a big part of my kind of field of interest.
Yeah, and your voice is also something that you use.
Yeah,
you know, as an instrument.
Yeah,
in terms of whether that's, you know, recording, writing, composer, like you say, you have so many hats that you wear.
Yeah.
You're not one thing, which is wonderful because, you know, you kind of flit around them all sort of thing. But how important is the voice when you are composing for film, and how do you use it?
It's very important to me because it's like it's the most direct musical access that I have to myself. And I've always sung, and my voice has always been a pretty big part of a musical expression. So I was singing in choir since I was 6 years old, and I was a professional singing child Viking in Iceland as a child.
Great image I have there of a professional child singing Viking.
Exactly.
I want to be her.
Yeah, exactly. I used to go with a flock of Vikings to like hijack buses full of tourists and drive them to a cave and I'd sing for them.
Like traditional songs?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
There's a film that you have to write a film to that. I'm coming to see that film.
Exactly. Yeah. No, for me, you know, music is, I'm not really a words person, and I have like, I really often get stuck with not finding the right words and, you know, having problems explaining myself but music I have a much easier time with because it somehow flows more naturally. The beauty of music as a form of communication, as a form of expression, I like being able to be flexible with the tonality. I don't like being kind of restricted by intonation, having to be very accurate or very kind of boxed in. So I the piano, for example, is an instrument that I have a bit of a hard time connecting to because I can't bend the notes. They're a little bit too precise.
Yeah.
And I like to be able to, both with my playing and my singing, to go from like really crystalline, pure, almost like sinus tones that I can then bend just to kind of, you know, instead of using vibrato, you know, to be very crystalline and then go somewhere, you know. So both the voice and the cello are really well suited for that sort of expression. So those are the kind of, these are the two instruments that I fall on the most for writing.
Yeah, almost that kind of thing where you can almost find new sounds every time you open your mouth or pick up your
cello. Exactly. And I think the more direct access you have to expression, like the kind of fewer things that get in the way, I think, you know, the kind of, for example, like, you know, having any sort of, I think the louder the inner chatterbox is, like, as you're working, the worse it is for me, at least, for, you know, if I'm thinking, like, is this cool, or is this, you know, does it fit this genre, or does it, like, is this instrument doing what, like, the louder this sort of chatter is, it's just, like, it really gets in my way. So it's really just rubbish, I think. So the so the more direct access I have to bypass that chatter, the better. So both the voice and the cello are good bypass.
That's a great way of describing it. Can you remember, though, because, you know, you recorded the, it was like a time 72 piece orchestra instruments in New York, but when you finally get to sit down and watch the film finished, locked, with that marriage of your sounds and your music with picture performance and stuff, what was your reaction to watching Joker that first time?
It was just, it was wonderful. It was really lovely. I mean, a lot of times I'm quite a hard critic on myself, and normally when I have to listen to my own music or watch my own work, I go through a lot of, there's a lot of criticism that happens, and I'm like, oh, why didn't I do it, or why was this edit like, you know, but this time I was really genuinely happy, and I actually had goosebumps, like, you know, most of the time, because I was, it was just so lovely seeing all these elements come together so beautifully. And as I say, so, you know, of course there were, like, as with any film, you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and there's a lot of back and forth, and you have problem scenes and all of that. But all in all, the dialogue was just so effortless somehow. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's always such a good sign. And then I can somehow rest comfortably with the storytelling being as true as possible.
Yeah.
Because there's, like, you know, not a lot of, like, politics or chatter that get in the way.
The way that you tell story through your music is extraordinary.
Thank
and
you.
That performance by Joaquin in that film, it's I don't think I've been impressed by a performance in a film like that for a very long time. It's just extraordinary. It's so great to, I mean, it must feel wonderful for you to know that was informed by the connection that you had with this story that you read physically.
Absolutely. No, it's a really... I think this is the this to me feels like the kind of the honest way to collaborate, when all the elements can really, like, genuinely influence each other, and there can be a dialogue more than directions or
do this, do that type thing. Was this a luxury, being able to work like this?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
This is not how it normally works.
No,
From people I've spoken to the past, I need a score in 10 days. The picture's edited. The film's edited.
Yeah,
I guess
exactly.
Every project's very different.
Every project's very different, definitely. But I'm super lucky that I'm in such a privileged position in that way that I'm normally not hired to be anything else than myself, you know. I'm not, because that's another problem that film composers often face, is that they have to be able to write, like, anyone in the world then, and yeah. I'm really not good at being anything else but myself. So I'd have a really hard time if that was the case for me.
It stood you in good stead so far.
Yeah, exactly. No, so it's a real privilege to be allowed to be yourself, you know, in this line of work. Not everyone gets hired on those premises. So I also, I guess at this point, I'm also known for wanting to take time. Like, I get really involved in projects that I'm working on. So I don't like to work on like a lot of things at the same time, because I like to be really dedicated to the process and to the project. Yeah. So it really, I'm not like a film composer. Like, you know, I don't really even see myself as a film composer. I just, you know, make music, and sometimes for a film. So I don't have like a huge team of people that are on my payroll, or, you know, of course I have people that work with me, but it's not like a big production. And I like to keep it like that. And therefore I'm, especially in the later years, I'm normally given a bit more time, and I'm invited to come in like earlier in the process, because people know this by now that I'm not going to churn out anything in two days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Chernobyl being an amazing example of that. Congratulations on everything with that, and the series as well. And, you know, the commitment you made to that so early on, visiting this set in Lithuania, you know, this decommissioned power plant where they were going to film. And, and again, it having to be a physical thing, you know, feeling and seeing this environment.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, I felt it was really important to understand the space, and to understand, because like in this story, like the space is such a huge part of the story, like the actual power plant. And
it's a character, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I really felt like I needed to understand the space, and I needed to feel the space, and I needed to be able to understand what radiation sounded like, because radiation is of course something that you can't capture with, you know, on screen. You can't see radiation. So I felt the music really needed to be the radiation, and I just really felt like I needed to understand it, and therefore like go there and have the space be the instrument, kind of. So there's no instruments in the whole series. My voice is the only kind of classical instrument that's kind of the human emotional connection, but otherwise I managed to, being pretty stubborn, managed to make up a musical instrument out of the power plant, so which took a lot of time and persistence, you know, to see that through. But in the end, it worked out.
And that, there's the burial song, which is just, oh my God, it's, and I love the journey that took of it being an old traditional song that was played at burials, but then manipulating it and making it yours and to fit within this narrative part of the storytelling.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I've been really lucky this year with both. I mean, I was working on Chernobyl and Joker completely hand in hand, like at the same time.
Wow.
So it was pretty intense year.
Dark days.
Yeah, very dark days. Pretty dark. I had a pretty dark year.
Hence why you're for the football with your kids straight after. Here we go.
Exactly. But I was just, it was a real, both projects were just so wonderful to work on, you know, despite the dark subjects. Because I really had a lot of space and a lot of time and a lot of trust, you know. I mean, I can imagine what the producers might have thought when I started out with Chernobyl, saying like, I want the whole music just to be coming from this power plant, you know. I don't know what went through their heads when we started out on that journey, but they trusted me through the whole process and never lost faith. And that's just a real, you know, it's a real privilege to feel that level of trust and you know, to allow that journey to happen without much interruption. You know, it's a real privilege.
Would you mind if I talked very briefly about Johan and working with him and that kind of wonderful journey that you guys had as, you know, working together and playing, and then the wonderful job that you did with Mary Magdalene as well, which we've spoken about and played on the show already and stuff. And was he a bit like a mentor in a way for you, or what was that?
No, not at all. No, it's a bit of a misunderstanding happened.
But that's
all
lovely. Exactly.
Well, I mean, of course, we knew each other from like the mid-late 90s, you know, because we were both from Iceland. Yeah. And, you know, of course, the music scene is very small. So we had been involved in, you know, a lot of the same, same concerts and events so in 2003, we started our first kind of duet collaboration for an Italian dance piece. And so that was the beginning of our kind of this collaboration that we had that lasted throughout his whole life, which was, was almost like 20 years of constant collaboration. Yeah. So we worked pretty much on every single project that both of us were working on throughout that time. But it wasn't like a mentor-student relationship at all. It was always very collaborative. I mean, he never really wrote any of the parts for me. Very much just like a response to our friendship, and you know, our dialogue was largely through music. So we shared 20 years of a very strong dialogue with each other through that. Yeah.
And we have that music to enjoy, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
And one of those films that Todd talked about when he was talking about you was Sicario 2, and how much he loved that score.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched it again 2 nights ago. I hadn't watched the film for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's what an interesting role that score plays in the film. It's so important and so brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think that's what's so great about when you kind of stop to kind of look at all these wonderful pieces that you've created for film specifically, is that nothing's the same, but each one fulfills such a specific thing for the film that it's almost like a missing piece, is fair to sort of say.
Oh, great, yeah.
But with Sicario 2, what are your memories of working and creating that sort of soundscape and those pieces for that?
Yeah. Well, that was it was in some ways quite a challenging process, actually, because, of course, like it's a sequel to Sicario, and Johan had like written that score, which became really quite influential on the scores to come after that. So it's been like, I don't know how many copies I've heard of that.
That's
quite a few. So it was quite funny to, I was a really big part of Sicario 1, of course. I played all the cello parts, and like a lot of the string parts are based on things that I had played and been like kind of a part of arranging so therefore, like, you know, I was hired because of my connection to the first score, and because my sound was already such a big part of the first one. So in some ways it was, the music came quite naturally because it was somewhat like a logical logical way forward from the first one. But it was also like a little bit funny to somehow not want to become one of that copycat scores of the the first score, which was also myself. So it was like, it was the kind of like, how do I not copy myself, but like, you know, not. So it was quite a funny process. But of course, like, you know, it had to have a connection to the first one. But at the same time, the story was quite different from the first one.
I think it's because the focus was different.
Yes, absolutely. And there was so many elements of the story in the second one that are like a lot more emotional, and you know, it's the whole journey between the between him and the girl, and you know, so the score somehow needed to be more emotional than the first one was.
Yeah.
And there needed to be like a lot more score, because the first one was only 40 minutes of music in that film, and it's like those, they're always like these kind of big musical statements, but which works so wonderfully for that film, and somehow this film needed a little bit more of support to be carried throughout some of the scenes. So so the role was a bit different. But I think in the end it came out
got,
okay.
Yeah. It's got its own place. Definitely.
Exactly.
I'm so excited to see what's next from you. I don't know if you're working on something at the minute or not, but I assume you are, because...
No, I'm not working on anything, actually.
Oh, wow, holidays.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, not exactly. It's been kind of, everything kind of blew up. Like, I wasn't really expecting this reaction to either Joker or to Novel.
Really? So,
yeah.
Wow.
I hadn't really, I wasn't prepared for the explosion.
I think you should also be prepared for like what we were talking about with that. Actually, also with Arrival, there was like straight after that, you could hear all these copycat.
Yes, exactly.
So Arrival's a crime. Yeah. So I think you need to be prepared for the copycatcher, Noble and Joker scores to kind of follow after on these ones as well. That's coming.
Yeah. But it's always kind of interesting to when that happens, you're like, oh, okay, well, that's a little bit obvious. But I mean, it's of course, like, you know, it's flattering as well. And it doesn't bother me at all.
It's lazy, but it's
Could have maybe changed the BPM at least. But I'm taking a little bit of time to, because last year was really intense with both projects happening, and the reaction has been so strong. So I'm kind of just trying to gather myself throughout the whole
process. I think you're going to have a busy start of 2020 as well with all those events that happen around films. So I think, but it's an absolute treat to get to chat to you. I'm such fans of what you do.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
the score to Joker, that's Confession by Hilda Gudnadottir, rounding off this first part of our soundtracking double bill. Next up, Dolly Wells, writer, actor and all-round top lass, who's just made her directorial debut with Good Posture. And among the many needle drops she personally chose for the film is the wonderful Bang On by The Breeders. Hi, Dolly Wells.
Hello.
This is really lovely.
This is very, very nice to be here with you.
I'm trying to remember when you very kindly invited me along to watch your film.
Oh, yes.
I mean, this is months ago, Good Posture.
Yes, this was last... Okay, what month are we now?
We're in October.
October. So it was it was the beginning of this year, or was it like April?
Was it?
Yeah, maybe April or May of this... No, because it was at Tribeca at April.
Yes, it was before that.
So it was before
the beginning of
February
the year.
Or something, yes.
And I have to say massive congratulations on the film. And I said that to you back then, that it was such an... I just felt like it was such an accomplished piece of work, that it felt like along the way, doing all the things that you've done and all the different types of productions that you've been involved in, TV, film, comedy, drama, all that, have all kind of... almost like you've kind of taken little bits along the way that have given you the confidence to... write and direct your first feature, would you agree?
Yes, I think it's a whole combination of all those things. I don't know if you ever feel that you've totally got the confidence, but you feel, and also I was sort of pushed into doing it, which I'm so pleased that I was.
Who by?
Jamie Adams, who makes those, he makes improvised films.
And I was in
Black Mountain Poets I was in.
Yeah.
And then he's just done Balance, Not Symmetry.
Symmetry, which Biffy Clyro did the soundtrack
exactly,
for, which was awesome.
Yeah, and he is really inspiring because he just sort of was like, I can make these films, I'm going to do it. And he made millions isn't quite right, but he's made about 8. And he said, I'd like you to make one. I'd like you to tell a story. And it was, he asked me about 3 years ago and I was like, nope, just don't dare. So I said no. And instead I did a play off Broadway, which Grace, who plays Lillian in the film, was played my daughter. And so I wouldn't have been able to if I hadn't met her. So, you know, all worked out. But then the next year he said, again, I think you have to say yes this time because otherwise they might not offer you the money to make this film. I was like, okay. But yes, I totally agree. I think it is a combination of all sorts of things that I've done until now, a sort of tone that I really like that I mean, it's not exactly the same as Doll and Em, but that's sort of slightly, that there's comedy, but there's also something quite sad and striving to sort of find your way.
How did you come to the decision on what you wanted to write about for the film, what you wanted the story to be?
I can remember my husband saying, oh, I've got an idea. I saw this journalist in the street and he had this. He came to me with something that was really cool, but it wasn't kind of my voice. It wasn't quite. So that from then I was like, OK, well, there's something I'm not necessarily going to do. But it was quite interesting about the relationship with these two people. And then I was interested. My cousin had stayed with a writer and I found that interesting. And then I read this book, Gratitude, by Jenny Dinsky, that was about Doris Lessing and how she'd lived with her. And I thought that was really interesting. So I stopped reading it because I was thinking, okay, this is really good. This is definitely along the lines of something I want to do. So I'm not going to. So I think I'm not sure where in my mind that idea was, but it just started to percolate. And I didn't have very long, which was good as well, to write it. I only had about 6 weeks to write the film.
Wow.
because there was a date that they knew that they wanted to film. I'm not exactly sure where it came from, but I think it was the idea of a reclusive writer and a young woman who had sort of no interest in her writing and how what would happen sort of came to me.
Because deadlines as well is really interesting. When we've spoken to various creatives on the show, I was speaking to a composer called Matthew Herbert last week, and he was like, he got asked to write a score for an entire film in something like 2 weeks. And it's like, bloody hell. But being under pressure, I don't know if, I mean, I'm a I realize I'm the biggest procrastinator in the world when I'm given too much time to do things, sort of thing. So those deadlines can really work in your favor.
They really can. And even the fear of it, I can remember just being like 24 days left, 19 days left. How far am I? And starting out with those, you know, those film cards, those sort of that you put your shots, and just sitting, just taking pictures of them and then turning them around and just being sort of too scared to do anything. And I didn't want anybody to read it. And I was, you know, I mean, I felt, and also it's the first time I've written on my own, not with Emily.
Yeah.
But yeah, deadlines definitely are something that I respond to.
And then on that first day of shooting, when it's your story, you're directing it, you're in charge, what's that feeling like?
It's abject terror because that day, I mean, it's really exciting, but I have a habit of going icy calm when I'm really nervous. And Zadie Smith had 2 hours when she wasn't, something she had to take one daughter to do something. She was going to pick her kids up and she was so sweet and gracious and up for doing it. But she was waiting downstairs and I could see that something was happening, but I was like, what's everything right? And the lenses hadn't arrived. And it was a 12-day shoot already, our film. So it was and we've now lost half of one day. So we've lost like a 20th of the whole production. And there was no one because I'd never directed anything before as well. You couldn't work out, you were sort of going to one person. They were like, no, not me. I don't know where the lenses are. Who should I ask where the lenses are? Like trying to be so calm. And then Maggie Monteith, our producer, was incredible. Just fingers going a million miles an hour on her phone. And they arrived, but they didn't arrive for the first bit. So we had to use. So when we were doing the interview bits where we were filming Zadie and Jonathan and Martin later on, we had to use these shitty interview cameras because they hadn't turned up. But so it
works though.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Totally.
That's what you realise, which is so good about all these happy accidents. You have to keep going, yeah, no, that works too. Does that work? Yeah, yeah, that works. The fact that whose POV is that? Yeah, yeah, it works. But it felt really, you had to sort of pinch yourself. I mean, that was good as well, but in a way that it was quite short because you didn't have the time to feel too nervous. You just had to stay right in the moment because otherwise you'd waste half an hour and that would be so much.
You know? Yeah. Did you think about the sound of the film, like having music and things?
Yes. I really minded about which songs it was going to be and chose the songs, obviously. And there were songs that like the Karen O song, Sing Along. I knew that I was listening to that Crush Songs album all the time while I was writing the film. So that was, I knew once I'd worked out, because there's a scene anyway where that song happens. And I didn't want there to be talking in that scene because I felt like it would be too sort of on the nose and expositional. Mm-hmm. I felt like, so that song was part of the story for me. And then the Yvonne Harris song, Near to Me, my husband was listening to in the shower and I was like, well, he was listening to a reggae compilation of a couple of us. And I was like, that song is amazing. And I couldn't stop listening to it. And it was the same thing. That sort of informed the story as well.
Amazing.
Because what she was saying about near to you, but I'm far away. And it was, anyway, don't want to give plot away about one little thing. But yeah, so the music was really important. Yeah.
To think that you had music around whilst you were writing, then what did that help with? Was it
character? Was it kind of narrative, emotion, all of it?
Yeah, I think emotion and tone, and that it was part of, you know, that they were, you know, well, Lillian hadn't worked out, or hadn't by the end of the film worked out who she, what she wants to be, but that it's about sort of creatives, like the husband isn't, has not found his way with music, but that's what he wants to be doing. And Julia is a very successful, in theory, writer and everything, but she's also struggling with her own thing. So I suppose music was just a part of the art of it.
I guess as well, though, it's like, because music can also distract you in a way as well, not, take you away from where you're trying to get to as well. So, you know, if there's things on that, that are kind of going, no, God, no, you know, kind of almost making that choice to switch things off or move away from those type of things as well, because it's, and also that's another choice as well when you're making something, of knowing where music works, but also where it doesn't work. Yeah. Because it can kind of contradict or do that thing of pushing audience too far in one way.
Yes, which I find, I hate that when it's like sort of, and just in case we haven't made it clear, this is how you're supposed to feel. You know, I can't bear that. I feel like, no, I'm just not going to feel that now. I'm not going to be sort of corralled, you know.
You're that one person in the cinema.
No, I'm not going to cry.
Who's laughing whilst everyone else is absolutely bawling their eyes out.
God, I was remembering that yesterday. It was so weird that I watched... The Notebook. I'd never ever seen it before, and Elsie, my daughter, she played it to me about 3 years ago, and I did some really bizarre thing where I couldn't stop crying. Yeah. I cried from that film for about 3 hours.
Yeah,
she had to call my husband, and he came back from Manhattan. He was doing something because she was like, "It's really weird. She still hasn't stopped crying." It's something very. It was like a sort of
rain
or tap. I couldn't work out what it was, and that was probably the music. But yeah, no.
It's just Ryan Gosling. Period.
Something about that film, and I wasn't even particularly enjoying it. I mean, I was. But I was just like, oh no, something's happening. I was washing up, I was crying, I went upstairs, I had a bath, I was still crying. I was like, this has really got to let up. It was so weird.
It's raining, I'm crying, all of that.
It was really bizarre.
Some films are like that though as well. They just kind of, I don't know, they get under your, they almost like take control of you in a way. It's so weird.
You can't,
I watched Judy the other night, the Renée Zellweger film, and it's the kind of crescendo in that to this performance that she has of Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me. Where troubles melt like lemon drops, away above the chimney tops, that's where you
almost that thing of you're waiting for that song throughout the whole film, because it's such a part of that woman, of, you know, and weirdly just had a relevance to her whole story. You know what I mean? It's so sad, but oh my God, similarly, kind of, I was just like, I don't think I've ever cried like that, where it just felt like the water wasn't just like streaming, it was pouring out of my eyeballs. It was like, all right, stop now, you're embarrassing yourself, kind of thing. But yeah, that was, it's crazy when films do that, you don't even like want it to.
No, I took two of my goddaughters to see Les Miserables, and one of them, like me, was sort of quite calm. We were crying a bit. But the other one, oh my goodness, I mean, it's part of her absolute charm, was just howling, like howling. And we were sort of person, oh, so sweet. Marth, Keith, you know? Okay, yeah, I think everyone else is like, I mean, she just cried. So, it was crazy. I was impressed that she could cry that loudly, because I wasn't sure if it was complete, but it was just mad, yeah.
Do you remember films that have, where music as part of the kind of journey and the experience have really resonated with you over the years as a film fan of watching things?
Yeah, see, it's so weird. I can't, like, suddenly Paris, Texas comes into my mind. Great. But I probably haven't seen that for so long.
But
that
great, isn't it? Yeah. You know, just there.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the soundtrack of a film is so if it's got right, it's just so wonderful, because yeah. It is definitely a huge, huge part of the film. Mm.
Did you have a music supervisor on the film then at all? Or, and did you think about going the traditional route of composer and things like that?
No, I didn't have a supervisor. That was me, I suppose, because I chose the songs. But then I had a fantastic woman called Heather Christian who did the... she was the composer, yeah. She did the singing and the piano. That was really lovely.
If you're blue, take the blue and stuff it in the sea, around a drain, around a stove pipe, as long as you can see me, wave my little hand. And if you're mad, take your mad and stuff it down your throat. Take a shower at your neighbor's house. Maybe you can call that being a little brave.
And what were the conversations you had with her in terms of what, or the ask of what you wanted?
Yeah, it was really difficult because I was sort of saying to her, I don't have the language for this conversation, but
you have
was,
the emotion,
yeah,
and the story.
That's what I would talk to her about. That's what was really great. I mean, she, funnily enough, had been my son's my daughter's piano teacher, and my son, she taught my son songwriting when we first moved to America.
Oh, wow.
And she's really wonderful, and she is incredible, actually. I mean, she's so interesting and original. And but so, yeah, I talked about emotion of moments, and I talked about, like, I'd love there to be just the piano here, or I'd like this to feel like it's round, you know. So yes, I had the sort of very simple language. Mm-hmm. But she was really receptive to that, and then it was a lot of her sending me something and being like, I love so much of that, but I'd love there to be fewer instruments. But there were moments that it was difficult, like when Grace Firth sits on the stairs when she's about to move into this house, mm-hmm. and you don't want to tell anybody anything too early. And there's so many complicated things that one topples something else. But yeah, it was fantastic, because that's the feeling I really felt with everybody that I was working with, was that I had the language for the actors, just because I've been acting for so long. That I would know, or I didn't know, but I felt I knew how I would want to be told.
Yeah.
But when you were talking to, like, my cinematographer, Ryan Edelston, that I'd be like, I can remember saying, I'm not feeling quite enough here. And he was like, okay. I was like, okay, can we come further back? No, I'm not feeling. Can we go to, like, no, I'm still not feeling. Just put Emily in, have her from back. Okay, now I'm feeling it. You know, and so you didn't even know.
Yeah.
Sometimes what it was. It was just, I knew exactly what I didn't want.
Yeah.
But they were such a collaborative bunch. It was just so fantastic. It felt really exciting. Like, they weren't patronising, or it was like we were all equally excited that we had this short time to make this thing.
Was this the first score that she'd worked on then? Or she had
No, she did the score for Lemon, do you know, that film that Jeanette Sobravo made. I'm not sure if she's done other films, but that was the one that I knew.
It's really nice. Do you think you could have made the film... set it in the UK?
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I could. It's so weird that someone asked me that. And I was thinking, where would I have set it? Like Kilburn or like Willesden? Or I don't think I could.
Yeah.
But, and I think part of that maybe is because it felt like I was doing it in a bubble there. Because although it's my home and it is where I live, Brooklyn, and right very, very near where I shot everything, I think that it felt like there were, not that there would have been eyes on me, but because I'm from London, all my family, my friends, I feel like they would have been coming to have a look, or I would have just felt shyer, like there was more expected of me. And there it was like, no one really knows what I'm doing. I'm just making this film. I'm not sort of talking about it.
And that's what people do there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean as well? Yeah. So it's like, people don't look twice.
No. Although where we were shooting, it was so funny because it was tiny budget and everything was really quick. And, you know, there'd be a shot where the light was going. It was sort of, and the seasons would change. Because, you know, it was all just sort of bonkers. But there were four men. The road that was supposed to be Emily's house is quite, all around that area where we live, is quite sort of noisy outdoor life and quite sort of wild, roundy. There were four guys that started getting drunk at about 11 in the morning, and it was now about 7. And they were so pissed. And you could just hear it's getting louder and louder. Go back to Hollywood. And I was just thinking, oh, we really are not from Hollywood. And there was, it was just like, oh, do we just, so we just left it. Because it was like, we don't want to piss these people off. It's their street. We don't, I mean, I sort of understand it. We do look annoying. Okay, fine. But that was quite hard to cut around. There were loads of things like that. Because there was no, we didn't have enough people to be stopping things.
Or yeah.
You know, stopping traffic or anything like that.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about Doll and M?
Please.
Because I loved that. 24 episodes, was it? That's a lot of writing.
Only 12.
Was it?
Yeah, because it was six. We did two seasons and it was just six the first episodes. And six the second, which I think is more English. I
mean, yeah.
Because I don't think that would have been allowed if we'd had it commissioned in America.
I loved that series. How did you write it?
We wrote it funnily enough, the very first episode of the first season, we were trying to work out with our director, Azazel Jacobs, he's a brilliant friend and director. Em and I thought, first of all, that it was going to be a play.
Okay.
I know, so weird, because we were really inspired by All About Eve and The Servant. And we sort of pictured this trailer on open, like sort of Jerusalem or something, coming to play. And then it was like, hang on, how's this going to work? And Emily lives in America and I live in London and this is just going to be so much work and it's not just going to happen. And then we thought maybe it would be a film. And then as I was saying, let's just film the scenes that we're excited about or that we've been talking about and just see. And Emily was filming the newsroom. So we shot 5 or 6 scenes with her in her costume in the trailer, sort of really quick. I can remember me and Azza and the DP, Tobias Datum and Emily, all piling out of the thingy and one of the cast being like, what's going on there? Are you having a gangbang? And we're like, no, we're not having a gangbang. We're making a very quiet film. Although they had an American accent. It was Olivia Munn, actually, that's right. But so we shot these scenes. We shot sort of 5 or 6 scenes. And then Azza sent us this. That's the answer. The long answer to your question is we didn't write those. We just had rehearsed them. So we sit on the floor when she had to get up very early to do the newsroom, just practicing again and again and again what we'd say in these handful of scenes.
Wow.
And then we shot them, like the one where she's on the, you know, where she's on the sofa and getting the ice cream. And
yeah.
And then once that was sent to us, and Azza was like, this feels like an episode or something.
Yeah.
Then we knew there had to be more because it wasn't long enough. Then we wrote the other scenes. And then from going on, from then onwards, we always wrote them. And we would write them when we were together, we'd just sit next to each other and do way too much chatting, but on the computer. And then if we weren't there together, one would write a scene and send it and the other one would change it. And then, so we'd take a scene each.
Amazing.
And then you send it to each other and you edit it. And then you get to a point, which is really nice, where you don't even really know who's written what or how it's turned into that thing. You know?
Was it nice to kind of have fun writing a character for yourself?
Yes. It was really fun writing both, because I think probably why it works is because you can, without sounding sort of mawkish, you can sort of see the love that in real life we have for each other. So it doesn't feel like a band being put together or something. Like two people really wanted to write their own thing, jokes. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like fighting with it. Like we just wanted to write this thing about these two people. So it wasn't like, you know, if I came up with an idea for Em or she came up with an idea for me, that was just as pleasurable. Or like, I mean, I can remember just finding it so enjoyable, her as the old lady. I can't remember that episode 5, the first season. And I just found, and there would be things that like she would just be being so funny that would be really enjoyable and surprising that you'd get just as much pleasure writing for yourself. But yeah, it was really fun writing for both of us. Yeah.
Do you think there could be more?
Then we are currently writing something else together.
Yes.
Yes. It's not Doll and M, but it's something else.
That makes me so excited. I love the idea of that. So, and did you because you'd written it, and obviously you're in it, but you had Azazel, who's amazing. Mm. But did you get involved in that side of it, in the kind of after you'd shot it, basically, in terms of construction of the episodes? And Mandy was composing it. Yes. Mandy Hoffman, who's amazing.
She's brilliant, yeah. And Azza had already worked with her. No, Azza was editing it in LA, and we would come in. I can't remember. I think I was filming, Blunt Talk when it was the second season. We were definitely very much involved. We were also all the producers. So, you know, you'd be being sent things and you'd be having ideas, definitely all of us. But I felt very safe and Azza's, you know, direction and everything. But, you know, the way, but yeah, we were, it was, that was really nice. It was really collaborative.
Yeah. I've got to talk about Can You Ever Forgive Me as well, whilst you're here, which was just extraordinary.
It was such a great film. I was so lucky to be part of that.
I mean, Marielle's just done, she did an amazing job with that film. And I imagine a very small budget and kind of tight shooting schedule and things like that. But the performances that she got out of that, and your character Anna as well, and how important she is to the whole narrative of both those characters as well, was extraordinary. What was your reaction when you first read the script and when you were first got that part?
I was really thrilled to get it. I mean, I was thinking, I've never played a part like her before. She's like a child, you know, that her friends are all the sort of ghosts of writers or whatever, that she's trying to keep her dad's bookshop going. And she's got a sort of quite a thin skin or something, it felt like. Like she was quite naive. You sort of imagine her sort of floating through New York. So I thought
in
it was
her own little world, yeah.
Yeah, it was something really so sweet. And also, I just loved, I hadn't read Can You Ever Forgive Me? I mean, I read it after reading the script. But I also loved the fact that there was a little bit of attention and time on a woman who's cantankerous and drinks too much and isn't successful and isn't sort of obviously attractive and charming. You know, that I just thought she was such a... Because I feel like there are so many people. It's almost like you're not allowed to, if you reach sort of 30 or 40 or 50, you're not allowed to say that you're a writer unless you've made...
Yeah.
Unless your books are in the front window
or
whatever. And it was... And that it's so silly because there's so many people that I know all through my mother-in-law or my father-in-law or friends, my parents or our friends who are like... They're just doing the thing that they're doing. They just make you, maybe you don't know who they are. And I remember feeling that it used to give me solace in New York when I was feeling lonely was the music on the subway. There'd be people that were really brilliant. And you're like, this is just a choice or your life is taking you this way.
Yeah.
You're getting as much pleasure from playing
to
40 people on the subway as if you were sort of, everyone's going, ah! You know?
Yeah, playing Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, exactly. And so I found there's something very lovely about the specificity of the script, of that story. And I remember my husband saying that, they were just, the first time we watched it together, just saying those are real Jack Hawk and those are real characters. I remember he lived in the Chelsea Hotel when he was little and he was like, these these are real people. These are totally believable, real characters. And it's really lovely seeing them. And also that it was just the end of something like bookshops and, you know.
Yeah. That scene in particular with you and Melissa at dinner was that fully scripted? Did you have much opportunity to kind of... You know, was it loose or were
No, it was fully scripted. Yeah, I can remember feeling really nervous on that day.
Were
I wonder
you?
If that was my first. Well, Murray is so cool because she doesn't. You feel like you're being really watched, which is so nice. Mm-hmm. But it would just be like a little tweak, or she'll come over and it's brief. It's sort of like she just gives you a little thing, and you're like, oh, great, fantastic. She would try and make me stay speaking with an American accent all the time, and I was so trying to impress Melissa because I was just like, oh, I can't believe I'm working Melissa's. And it was at the same time that she was doing that Sean Spicer thing that was just too funny. You just couldn't believe the genius of that. Like, I sort of watch it again and again and again, try and be cool about it. Like, it's quite funny. Yeah, it's good. I was telling her something, I can't remember what I was telling her, and she's so warm and funny and cool. And Melissa just came over and was like, can you finish that with an American accent? I was like, not really. Oh, God, okay. Yeah, no, sure, I will. Oh, and then you sort of go, I can't, so I have to say this with my accent because I can't even do this. But it was a lovely thing to be a part of. Everybody, like Arjun, who did the wardrobe, like every aspect of it was so good. It just looked perfect, I thought. And it was a short shoot. I mean, I was only in for about 5 days.
Wow.
But that scene, in the restaurant was really special. I mean, it felt like it was such fun acting opposite Melissa. And there was something so, so sad.
Mm.
You know, she was just, I know people like her. She was just sort of tough, pretending to be. But there was something it was so like an onion, so many layers, her performance of that.
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I was lucky enough to sort of do quite a few Q&As with Richard sort of around it, and just hearing him talk about the experience on set of what that was like, it was it sounded pretty special. I had a thought that just popped in my head there. Totally American accents, you nailed them though, because you're married to an American, mm-hmm. you live in America, mm-hmm. you, nothing to worry about, come on.
Well, you say that, my kids are quite mean, they're like, oh your accent, you have to, what I have to do, and I'm panicking so I'm doing something next week, we have to be American, I've got to really get on with it, is you do have to do quite a lot of work, because even though I'm married to an American, I've been with him for so many years and I live in America, there is still something like your mouth you know, your tongue moves in a completely different way. You use a different part of your mouth.
So many different accents as well.
So many different accents. And so it is, I do find it quite hard, and I don't find doing accents that hard. Mm. I mean, I like doing sort of European accents, but it is quite difficult. No, and then I did Room 104, you know, that the Duplass brothers did.
Yeah.
I love doing that. And that was like, me and my husband were like, okay, I'm going to watch it now. And it's 30 minutes and it was just me on screen. It's called The Woman in the Wall. And there was, and it was like, oh, hold on to the sofa, because there's got to be a bit. If I'm talking, if it's just me talking for 30 minutes, it's going to be a sort of father or something terrible is going to come out. And we're just like, no, I think it's all right. It's still all right. It's all right. I think it's all right. Oh, I think that was all right. But it doesn't mean there won't be times. I mean, in Home Again, which is that Reese Witherspoon
film. Oh, my God. So I didn't know you were in that film, right? And I went to watch it, and I verbally, in a cinema full of like film scary critics, mainly like grumpy old men, just went, Dolly! The screen. I was so excited to see
you. It
was
so bizarre. I was so surprised that I was in it too. But it was, that was really fun, and she was so wonderful. But I was trying to explain to the cast, because they were saying, you can improvise in this scene. And I was like, I won't be talking in this scene. And they're like, why? And I was going, because, okay, you try and pretend now that, so you're playing an English person. Just improvise. Where are you from? Are you from Hackney? Like, it was like, I can improvise in a different accent, but I just don't know what I will say once I start improvising, because I don't know where I'm from. Once I start just talking, you know, so I don't have the confidence to be just sort of going right off, you know. So I was just sort of smiling, because I felt too shy. I felt like, you know, oh, I don't know. And they were like, okay, I get what you mean. I was like, well.
How, I wanted to ask about, when you look back at all the brilliant stuff as well that you've done with regards to comedy here in the UK, and all the brilliant shows that you've been part of, you know, IT Crowd, Peep Show, Mighty Boosh, all that kind of gang and stuff as well. And it's interesting to hear people talk about how comedy is a brilliant training in terms of timing and things for dramatic stuff.
I think so. I really do. I think that it's almost the stuff in the middle that's harder. I think comedy and drama lend themselves. Like, I can remember Melissa kept getting asked that, like, oh, it's a whole different genre. And she's like, well, not really, because you're just being, I mean, unless you're like Lauren Hardy or something. I mean, you're trying to do the comedy seriously. I'm not very good at doing like really big sort of anything that much, I don't think. Like, I had to do, oh no, I can't say yet. I'll say next time.
Nearly!
I so nearly did. I would have got a phone call. No, there's certain bits when you have to do the sort of responding that I'm terrible at, or the screaming, or the sort of, you know, but I think that you do. Yeah, I think it is a good preparation. I think they're not that far apart. But often people are so surprised when somebody who can do comedy well can do serious drama. And I think it's not, to me, it's not that surprising.
Yeah. Has the experience of good posture really kind of encouraged you, and the response that you've had from it so far, which has been brilliant, to do more?
Yes.
Great.
Definitely. Definitely. Someone, it was hilarious. Someone, I was in a sort of bad mood, and someone said, do you want to write and direct anymore? But what are you planning to do? And I went, not sure. But I was sort of joking. And then I got an email the next day saying, so sad to hear that you don't want to. And I was like, I was joking.
Because here's four scripts for you to direct.
No, I definitely, definitely do.
That's great. Yeah. And write is, I guess, because you've had that wonderful experience of writing and directing, you know, your first feature. Is that a luxury? I imagine it's a very different experience, the idea of taking someone else's script and directing it.
Yes, that makes it, I feel nervous, but that's okay. Someone just has to give me a deadline. I feel like, if it's something you've written yourself, you can see it so clearly. So I don't think I would be able to direct somebody else's film in 12 days. Like, you know, that I could choose the locations. I knew the mood of it. I could write the dialogue for each character because I knew the people. So I think that was a wonderful start. And I think there's something special about being able to write your own things. But also there's a challenge in directing somebody, you know, having a collaboration of like, you know, seeing this writer's world that they then can explain to you, and then you take it away and do something else. And
yeah. So when will that be?
I don't know. Not yet. tomorrow. No, I've got things I'm
How many
about.
Days did you say you're on it? Yeah, 6 weeks from now. Go.
Okay, starting. Okay, bye.
I can't wait to see what's next. And oh, I'm so happy for you with and I'm so just, it's just such a great film. It's great. And you've got great performances. And I just thought it was absolutely wonderful. And I said that to you, you know, when I saw it months ago sort of thing. And it's wonderful to see it being unleashed and people responding to it as well. So hurry up and do the next one.
Okay, I will.
Thanks, doll.
Thank you so much, Edith. Thank you.
takes the silver and it paints when she is told. Smudges a print across the paper at the fold. And put in front of her the next word to say. Leaving the door ajar, you will not complain.
Good Posture, that's Once Grown by Heather Christian. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Dolly Wells and Hilda Goodnotier. Now, my huge thanks to both Hilda and Dolly for taking the time to talk to us. Both Joker and Good Posture are on general release now, and you should definitely seek both of them out. Now, we will put up a Spotify playlist for this show via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including a very early outing for Todd Phillips. And I promise we are trying to make episode 2 of Todd Phillips happen. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And check out our YouTube channel if you have a moment for loads of extra content. Next up, we have a double bill of composers. But together, we're in the company of David Arnold and Michael Giacchino. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.